Our first guest in this new series is, as indeed it must be, Mark Stein. I say must be because he has long been just one of my favorites, if not, in fact, the favorites guest on the radio program, which we ran for some 38 years. Mark Stein, hello.
Hey, great to be back with you, Milt, and that is an honor when I look at the distinguished roster of guests you've had in the last several decades, from Mrs. Thatcher on down. So I'm honored by what you said, although I'm not entirely persuaded it's true.
It's too bad that I couldn't get you and Margaret Thatcher together.
Well, I tell you, the one thing I did find on the few occasions that Mrs. Thatcher and I did get together is that I had a terrible job keeping up with her when it came to the Scotch, she managed to remain incredibly articulate amidst all that until 3 a.m. I was less so. So I think she'd have had the edge on me there.
Now I will define what we're up to today, if of course you choose to accept it, and I'm going to do it in the Chinese style. We start with the four dismaying D's. Those dismaying D's are decay, dishonesty, decline, all of which you seem to specialize in as you look at the works and ways of the world around us. And the fourth D, then, is demographic disaster, which you tend to tie to the other earlier D's of decay, dishonesty, and decline. What I'm really dealing with there and trying to zero in on is that, in fact, you take the view, not unlike that of Edmund Burke, that human society and its institutions are all radically imperfectible. And the conservative task is to somehow hold things together in the face of impending and inevitable threat. Is that, in fact, your basic stance? Though I know you add to it the color of tremendous wit and a kind of ebullience, which I find unaccountable but delightful.
Well, I that is basically where I stand. One can quibble about how many D's there are. I don't think you had debt and decadence in there, but they're also part of it too. And it is hard. I mean, I should actually be incredibly pessimistic and incredibly gloomy. But in fact, if you look at the world a certain way, there is a kind of dark, mordant comedy to it. The news just the other day that the government of Massachusetts is trying to determine whether, in fact, the Tsarnaev brothers purchased the materials with which they blew up the Boston Marathon using food stamp cards. Is at one level black and depressing, but on the other hand, whoever succeeds us and whoever combs through our rubble, whether it's the Chinese or the Russians or the new caliphate or aliens from planet Zongo, they will find things like that incredibly hilarious. If we can't have the first laugh, we might as well. If we can't have the last laugh, we might as well have the first laugh.
You have just confirmed yet another hypothesis about. I keep looking for historical analogies to Mark Stein, and in addition to what I've just said about Jeremiah and you specializing in Jeremiads of a modern variety, it occurred to me that you are also not only Jeremiah come again, but I don't know how you'll react to this one. Till Eulenspiegel come again.
Well, that's no, I don't know about that. I mean, I'm in the.
He laughed at me.
I'm a merry prankster, yes. of a kind, but I don't think I'd quite go all the way with him.
Well, I'm glad that you partially reject it, because one does remember, of course, that society's ultimate response to Till Eulenspiegel for telling the truth about the decay and disorder and dishonesty of their society, the ultimate response from the those who control things was to kill Till Eulenspiegel.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, I'd forgotten that's how the poor guy ended up. I mean, one of the things I do, I sort of share with him is that I like the idea of just riffling through. I mean, he got around. He was in Belgium and Denmark and Poland and Italy. So he roamed far and wide for his day. One thing I do share in common with him is this idea of little isolated, disparate things all over the map that all cumulatively go towards a sort of a big picture that works as a whole. So in that sense, I'm not an Eulenspiegel-esque or whatever the word is.
Things are sort of falling into place today in terms of Chinese lists. And another thing I can easily come to, this being, in fact, the day that we're recording, Tuesday, May 14th, we have not only the four Ds, but we have the three scandals. And the third of those scandals popped just this morning, by which, of course, one makes reference to the persistence of the Benghazi scandal and then the IRS scandal, which we ran into just a few days ago, and now the Department of Justice scandal.
Yeah, and they remind me of something. I was down in Australia a few months ago, and an extremely eminent Australian politician, at the very top of Australian society, he'd just flown in, and we were having tea on one of the last days of my Australian tour, and he'd just been at Los Angeles Airport. And he said to me rather sadly, he said, "I don't feel America is quite a first world country anymore." And I thought of that line when I read about these three scandals, because in their way, they are all, it's all banana republic stuff. We're no longer dealing in a land of with a land of laws, but we're dealing with a land of caprices and whims, in which whether or not you attract the attention of the state commissar is entirely whimsical. In this case, we have the IRS, and again, this is the sort of thing that would be too cute if you were writing a satirical novel. But as evidence of on the search for as one of their search words to find as they saw it dangerous dissenting groups, the IRS used the word constitution to identify which of these various groups merited their closer attention. As I said, if you put that in a novel, it would be regarded as too cute. Then it turns out they're not just asking wholly inappropriate questions of American taxpayers. What are your attitudes toward the state of Israel? Are any family members of yours planning to run for office? But they're leaking this information to liberal groups that they do approve of, the whatever it's called, ProPolitica or whatever. That's Banana Republic stuff. The Justice Department seizing the phone records of journalists, that's Banana Republic stuff. And Benghazi, and I think this is why it's had such a stunning effect in the Middle East, and particularly among the Libyan political class, whatever one makes of them, they're looking at the United States government lying to its people as assiduously as any Gaddafi or Assad or Mubarak ever did. So that's the North African version of Banana Republic stuff too, and I think they're worrying to me because you can have societies that still have the outward organs of liberty and democracy and functioning institutions. They still have the outward signs of it, but inside they're corroding and decaying into something else. And these three stories, what's unnerving for me is that America is becoming a not quite respectable free society, and that's what this administration seems very comfortable with. That particularly figures like Eric Holder, but also the Education Department, which now wants mandatory speech codes on every American campus. Again, that's Banana Republic stuff too. You've got to be in conformity with the state ideology. I'm not saying it's where Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia, but we're decaying into something that has the outward institutions, but it's no longer quite a respectable free society.
Well, there's so much one could respond to in that. As an old academic, and indeed one of the founding members, and I guess still a board member, of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE, which is charged with trying to undo the speech codes on the university campuses, and in general charges itself with the task of policing the policemen, so to speak. I am rather disheartened and dismayed by the fact that it always regresses back to the attempt to control faculty and students and thought on almost all American campuses, including the elite ones. Indeed, one wonders what's happening on some of those elite campuses. Yale, where I started my academic career rather a long while ago, seems now to be distinguished more than anything else by its yielding to the requirements or claims of some of its undergraduates or maybe some of its younger faculty by having instituted and celebrating every year a great sex week in which people run around naked and otherwise talk about pornographic equipment.
That's interesting. I think that's actually not irrelevant. It's the left uses sexual liberty and the expansion of sexual liberty as the cover for the retreat of every other kind of liberty. In other words, people understand that if you can get it on with whatever you want, whenever you want, then people are less inclined to kick up a fuss about shrinking of free speech rights, shrinking of religious rights, shrinking of property rights, and all the rest of it. In other words, the idea of liberty is simply sexual liberty, which is very well advanced in our world now. That has provided a tremendous cover for a vast state grab on in every other sphere of liberty.
Is that, in essence, inevitable in large, overdeveloped, and overindulged, and overprofitable democratic or pseudo-democratic institutions, pseudo-democratic nations? I think not merely of ourselves, but I think of your other nation, namely Canada. You've done a good deal about what's gone wrong in Canada in recent years. And again, in the name of cultural pluralism and openness, there's been all sorts of crime perpetrated, including some crimes against you.
I think that's true. I mean, I think the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom. I mean, I would just leave it with the English-speaking democracies, because I think there's a difference in the Western world between the Anglophone world and continental Europe. Continental Europe gave us a lot of great art, the greatest art, the greatest music, but it wasn't so successful in transmitting enduring democratic institutions from one generation to the next. That's why highly civilized societies such as 19th century Germany, 30 years later, it was the most murderous dictatorship in history. But you can point to similar problems, though less genocidal, in France, in Italy, in basically a lot of the non-English speaking countries. But in the British Empire and in the United States, we have done a reasonably good job of expanding liberty peacefully, of evolving constitutionally over centuries. And we are at a very peculiar pass. Just to go back to the sex thing, California recently had the California legislature in Sacramento recently proposed mandating fitted sheets in Californian motels and hotels. That's to say, elasticated sheets in the name of health and safety, because apparently if a maid has to bend down to tuck the sheet in, she can risk putting her back out. That may be true, it may not be true, but I think if you run the Flea Pit Motel out on Route 473, in a free society, you should have the right to have an unfitted sheet on that bed. And it's fascinating me. Pierre Trudeau, longtime Prime Minister of Canada, when homosexuality was decriminalized in Canada, he said the state has no place in the bedrooms of the nation. The government of California says the state has no place in the bedroom in the bedrooms of the nation unless you're in there consummating your same-sex marriage on an unelasticated sheet, in which case they're going to send the Bureau of California sheet regulators to kick the door down and fine you for that. And it's bizarre to me that we now put up with intrusions on our private space that nobody in human history would have put up with before.
But if we don't do that intrusion with regard to fitted sheets, one hears a chorus, to be sure, in Spanish from chambermaids all over California saying in Spanish, however one does it, "Oh, my aching back."
that's right, and somehow it's the state. You can usually rely on the market to take care of those things. That if a chambermaid doesn't like working at the lousy motel that has the unfitted sheets, she'll get a job at the Ritz-Carlton, where the beds are higher and more plumped up, and the sheets are elasticated. Then the market usually takes care of those things. But we now have every aspect of life regulated. And it's extraordinary to me at the time, for example, you mentioned Benghazi. Benghazi, the guy speaks to Hillary Clinton at 8 p.m. in the evening, Washington time, 2 a.m. in the morning in Libya, and he tells her the facility in Benghazi is being attacked, and they don't know where the ambassador is. An hour later, the Libyan prime minister calls him up and says, we've found your ambassador, and unfortunately, he's dead. This guy, Hicks, is now the head American guy in Libya. He was the number two, but the ambassador is dead. He's now in charge. He calls Washington. It's 9 in the evening in Washington. He cannot get the Secretary of State on the phone. Even as the embassy is under attack and the ambassador is dead, he can't get hold of anyone in government who matters. Government does not have the resources to put someone on the phone in Washington to talk to him when a mob is firing RPGs at American sovereign territory in Libya and the ambassador is dead. And yet government has all the resources it needs to send officers round to hassle a 7-year-old girl who's running a lemonade stand without a $300 permit, to send federal agents, fish and game agents, round with state troopers to threaten a girl who rescued a woodpecker from the jaws of a cat. Government's got time for all of that. But the one time you need it, like the 3 a.m. call from Benghazi, then there's nobody around to answer.
Well, I fear, as usual, you're a little bit deficient in understanding the complexity of the situation, as one focuses, and one should focus upon, our relations with the Islamic or the Muslim world. Because there are niceties and complexities there which have to be not merely noted, but in some sense indulged. I offer you, and we're about to pause in just a moment, but I look forward to your response, I offer you a very telltale quotation which really defines the challenge and the great opportunity of this present moment between the West and the Near East, at least. Namely this, quote, "America and Islam are not exclusive and need not be in competition. Instead, they overlap, and they share common principles of justice and progress, of tolerance and the dignity of all human beings." You recognize that quotation?
No, I don't, actually. Who said that? I've heard a lot of things like
that. A rather prominent American. His name is Barack Obama.
And
I look forward to your response right after we pause just briefly for this. Return to Mark Stein, who has done us the honor of being guest on the very first of our new series of podcasts. Podcasts which you get to simply by going to miltrosenberg.com. And Mark, I quoted to you an old, a mutual friend of sorts, Barack Obama. You know, I discovered at the radio setup, I discovered a tape I did with Barack Obama when he was running for the State Senate in Illinois, and I just had his new book published. And we put it up as a podcast. We found it only years and years and years and years after it was originally done. But it elicited a considerable response, of course, from our audience and from me. As I listened to it, I thought him amiably evasive, amiably non-pin-downable. And this was when his ambition ran no further, like it maybe it did, of course, run considerably further, but his ambition was focused at the moment on getting into the state senate of Illinois. Well, we've just heard his comment. Here's another one. I consider it part of my responsibility as President of the United States to fight against negative stereotypes of Islam wherever they appear. Now, you're making really negative stereotypes and asserting them when you settle down for the thought that inevitably this is a terrorist attack out there in Benghazi, rather than a sort of a legitimate response to an anti-Islamic insulting video that was circulating rather widely.
Yeah, I mean, to go back to that first quotation of the president's melt, I don't know whether that was from his Cairo speech, but I think it's actually delusional. I think it's actually delusional. If you look at all the hot spots anywhere around the planet, these are what Samuel Huntington used to call Islam's bloody borders. In other words, where Islam bumps up against something else. And it doesn't really matter what the something else is. It can be Hindus in Kashmir. It can be Jews in Palestine and Israel. It can be Christians in Nigeria. It can be Buddhists in southern Thailand. It can be Australian backpackers in Bali. It can be Russian school children in the Caucasus. But basically, where Islam bumps up against the other, once it finds itself on the receiving end of Islam, it finds itself in a most uncomfortable situation. And that is the complete opposite of what Obama said when he said he saw them as overlapping and complementary. That's the real problem. The problem is what is complementary with Islam? Because as we see in Israel, the Jews aren't. As we see in Kashmir, the Hindus aren't. As we see in Nigeria, the Christians aren't. That seems to me the sort of thing you just pull out of the icebox from the standard, you know, multicultural diversity template. There's no difference between a fire-breathing imam with his four child brides and a nice congregational lesbian pastor living with the lesbian mother of her three children in some Connecticut suburb. They're all just people of the book. I think that is just – I think that sappy, happy – ludicrous diversity is actually extremely problematic. And one of the interesting features of the Boston incident, one of the most fascinating elements of that is the role of Tamerlan Tsarnaev's wife, who is a figure of interest for the FBI. Mm-hmm. This is a woman who came from a sort of conventional New England. I don't know whether her family actually came over on the Mayflower, but they sound as if they actually could have. She came from one of those small town Yankee backgrounds, and at some point she tells her parents that she's fallen in love with a Muslim guy and she's converting to Islam, and the girl who is just like a normal American co-ed suddenly starts going around as a covered woman. And of course the family immediately decide they're going to be very supportive, which is one of those buzzwords. That's one of those Princess Fluffy Bunny words in American life. The important thing is to be supportive. It's a secondary matter what you're being supportive of. So the important thing when your kid comes and tells you something is you be supportive and find out later what exactly it is that you're being supportive of. And I think we have to start relearning how to be, it's a bad word now, judgmental. We have to start learning how to be judgmental, actually to take enough to be genuinely multicultural enough to take an interest in a sufficient interest in people and places that we're capable of distinguishing between.
Well, let's shift the focus just a bit. You focus on the Tsarnaev brothers, and earlier, of course, quoting Sam Huntington, who, after all, was specializing in laying out the theory that we are engaged in a great clash of civilizations, and points us to Kashmir or to Israel or to what have you. But let me give you a geographic locus of closer proximity. Let's zero in, perhaps using our computers, let's zero in on Dearborn, Michigan, the single most Muslim enclave or small city in the country. Its population, I think, runs some 80% Middle Eastern Muslim. Could one not say that assimilation is doing its wonders, and there, just as in the hinterland, if not in London itself, that the hinterland of the UK, Muslims are going into another generation and are becoming essentially Brits, becoming essentially Americans, and the eternal threat of Islam, as Sam Huntington suggested was the case, really begins to fade away.
No, I think that's actually the opposite of what's happening, Milt. I think
I thought you would, and I was really setting you up to get you to say that.
Well, I think it's interesting that third generation Muslims are less assimilated in, you mentioned London, certainly less assimilated in London and in Europe and in parts of Canada than first generation.
Third generation Muslims who blew up those buses one day.
That's right. The London Tube bombings were committed by Muslims who had been born and bred in the United Kingdom. Again, I think that's true of the Tsarnaev brothers, for example. They came from a secular background, a sort of ethnic Chechen background from Dagestan. I love the way, you know, one of the fascinating things about this is that when people blow you up, you're obliged to take an interest in them. On September the 12th, all of us in the pundit class were suddenly experts on Afghanistan, and we were going around talking about Pashtuns and Uzbeks and all the rest of it as if we had a clue what we were talking about. And immediately after the Boston Marathon bombing, when it turns out these guys are Chechens, but in fact they never really lived in Chechnya, and their parents currently live in Dagestan, and so then you start talking about Dagestanis as if you know what the hell you're talking about. In fact, there are no Dagestanis. Dagestan has got every ethnic group conceivable except actual Dagestanis. It's got all these ones that sound like typing mistakes.
Well, they are all driving taxicabs in New York.
It's fascinating to me that how, you know, obscure peripheral Russian sub-republics can suddenly, whatever's going on there, can suddenly loom up and get you. I mean, but anyway, I was laughing my head off when you hear people talking about Dagestanis on the news, because there aren't Dagestanis. Dagestan's got Kumyks and Azeri and as I said, Lezgians, which sounds like a typing error, but in fact isn't. You'd like to think they were Lezgians, were these obscure warrior princesses in the hills of Dagestan, but in fact it's a particular ethnic group there. But the point here is that when they came, when the Tsarnaev's parents came to this country, they were more or less conventionally secular, post-Soviet citizens of the Caucasus. Their children were raised almost entirely in the West, and they've embraced this pan-Islamic, imperialist, conquering, globalist ideology. And that's very common. If you look at third generation Muslims in the Netherlands, if you look at in Canada, a girl who was arrested, her husband was arrested for plotting to behead the prime minister. Her grandfather is the pharmacist at the Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry Base in Alberta. He's a conventional first generation immigrant. He's a loyal Canadian who supports the troops and their mission in Afghanistan. His crazy daughter, names her kid after a Chechen jihadist, and wants her husband to sign a prenup, pledging that he'll commit jihad or the wedding is over. And I think what's happening here, what binds the Tsarnaevs to this family in Toronto, to the ones in the London tube bombings, to similar Muslims in France, the Netherlands, Belgium. What binds them together is that they have no real connection with wherever they've come from. They have no real connection back to their nominal homeland. They've never lived there. They have no memories of it. At the same time, they don't feel American or Canadian or Dutch or Belgian. And they're given no reason to feel American or Canadian or Dutch or Belgian. The Tsarnaevs went to what is famously the most diverse public school, one of the three most diverse public schools in America. It's whatever it's called, Ringen, Cambridge Ringen Latin or whatever it is, where there are over 80 different nationalities represented in the classroom. Nobody's teaching those guys about the Constitution and Thomas Jefferson and all the rest of it. You're being taught this multiculturalist vision of the developed world. And as with the London Tube Bombers, and as with the school the Canadian girl was at in Toronto, what you're left with is a vacuum, a nullity. And in that void, people search for alternative identity.
A modern social scientist who thinks he's very practical, but in fact is very limited in his understanding of the social order and the way in which it works, would probably riposte to you right now and say, yes, what we need is to separate them from some of the background groups which sustain them in their Islamic ferocity, and we need instead to give them much more American experience. Indeed, break up the groups and get them deeply involved in interaction with other Americans of various kinds, and the overall outcome will be a quicker assimilation and a more rapid shedding of the illusion of continuity with a past which really was never theirs and which they associate with their parents who were trying to get rid of it all along. Let's desegregate, so to speak, the ethnic enclaves, particularly the Islamic ethnic enclaves. Would that make any sense if put forward by an earnest and not terribly brilliant American sociologist?
Yeah, I don't think that would make. I mean, I think, for example, you see in Dearborn that has become very rapidly Muslim, in the same way you can find communities that have become very rapidly Hispanic or whatever. With the modern multicultural mind denies a basic reality of life, that people want to live among people who are like them. You notice it. I notice it in my part of the world, in New Hampshire, when you go to some. If you were at Dartmouth College, you know what Hanover, New Hampshire is like, Milt. And it always makes me laugh when you see people driving around there with the Celebrate Diversity bumper stickers. These are people who want to live in an upscale white liberal town. And they like their little diversity trophies. They like it if there's a Muslim software designer who moves in, or there'll be a professor from Hong Kong or whatever.
Not to mention a president who is, quote, safely black, because he isn't all that black.
Right. And they want, but they don't want, but they would be terrified if you told them that their children had to go to the same high school as the broken down Yankee hardscrabble flat natives 10 miles up the road. They would be absolutely horrified by that. Their diversity is limits. It's fascinating to me that Joe Klein from Time magazine was sneering at Sarah Palin and her Tea Party people for not embracing the joyous, wonderful diversity of America. Joe Klein lives in a town that is, I think, 98.1% white, just north of New York City. Now, he could go and live in the Bronx if he wants to, but he doesn't want to. He doesn't want to celebrate the diversity myth where he lives. So in a sense, when Dearborn, some Muslims moved to Dearborn, and then more Muslims moved to Dearborn, and then eventually, if you're a Muslim and you're looking for somewhere to live in Michigan, you think, Dearborn sounds like my kind of town. That's actually a very reasonable thing to do. Likewise, in Britain, where half the non-United Kingdom-born residents cluster in ever denser ethnic enclaves because that's where they feel most comfortable. I mean, I think it goes back. If you look at Tamerlan Tsarnaev put his wife, his American wife, in the burqa, in the hijab, it covered her from head to toe. That is a very interesting way of looking at it. You can't assimilate When you put your women folk in that garb, you're really saying, I do not want them to be fully participating members of the society in which we happen to be in the zip code in which we happen to find ourselves. I'm doing as much as I can to wall them off from that.
Yeah.
Literally, as they walk around the streets.
There is always the mystery of individual motivation. I'm regressing to being the psychologist I once was academically. And, you know, with regard to Tamerlan Tsarnaev, remember the name Tamerlan is Tamburlaine or Tamerlane,
right.
Who was a world conqueror, who was a scourge of the West as he rolled forward, setting the pattern that later was followed, I think, by Genghis Khan. Though maybe I got that in reverse.
Right.
I'm not sure.
No, that's right.
I wonder, to be named world conqueror may have something to do with your deciding, hell, I'll screw this thing up and shake it up a bit and we'll explode some bombs. The mystery of individual outcomes is really eternally persistent and eternally mysterious.
Yeah, but I think there's a basic question. I mean, I find the reaction to what happened in Boston horrifying in a way.
Of course.
Leaving aside the relatively low death toll, you look at people who are being carried away with their legs blown off. That's not when we say people have lost a limb. It doesn't sound like a big deal when you put it like that. But these people are going to be in excruciating pain for the rest of their lives. These are people who will never be able to participate in most kinds of sport for the rest of their lives. Their lives have changed. They will be living with the consequences of what the Tsarnaev brothers did. Forever, and that's before you talk about the Richard family, the little boy Martin, who 8 year old boy, who's killed, the sister who lost a leg, the mother who suffered severe brain injuries. Now, what did they do to deserve living the diversity dream? In other words, at a certain point, there was no need for the Tsarnaev brothers ever to be in the United States of America. No need whatsoever. And at some point, the Western society needs to. I'm not saying every immigrant to America. I'm an immigrant to America, and I have no desire to blow up any marathons or any of the rest of it. But I would expect the government that admitted me to this country to ask hard-headed questions. I had to demonstrate to the United States government that I would be an economic benefit to this country, and that I would not be a public charge upon the citizens of the United States. In other words, when I applied to enter this country, the United States turned back and said to me, "Yeah, well, what's in it for us?" And that's the question. That's the question all societies should be asking themselves. It's not worth as exciting and exotic as it may be to have some Chechens and Dagestanis sort of filling out the background. So like you're like a stamp collector who's got one of everything. Just filling in missing spaces on the diversity quilt is not justification for asking people to put up with what the people who were blown apart at the Boston Marathon are going to have to be living with for the rest of their lives.
Are you, in essence, convinced that there is something intrinsically, qualitatively different about Islam, as compared to the other, quote, peoples of the book, as compared to the other Western religions, namely Christianity in its 100 varieties and Judaism in its 5 or 6 varieties? Is there a qualitative difference?
Yeah, I think there is. I think Judaism, for example, is not universalist. Whereas the idea of people are fascinated by the idea of an international Jewish conspiracy and all the rest of it, and there are times when I wish there was one, or at least that I wish it was rather more effective. But nobody is going to be imposing a global Jewish caliphate. And likewise, I think the difference between Christianity and Islam is there really at the beginning, when you compare Jesus's final words to his disciples before he ascended into heaven, with Muhammad's final words to his disciples. Jesus told them to go to to every corner of the then known world and convert people to Christianity, and Muhammad told them to go and forcibly make everyone submit to Islam. And I think that's the difference. If you look at Christianity in the Roman Empire, Christianity started at the bottom. The nobodies, the schlubs converted to it, the servants. And then eventually it spread all the way up the chain until, you know, the emperor is the last piece of the puzzle, basically. It's the opposite way round. At the height of Islamic power, when they conquered Spain and they were at the gates of Vienna, they would conquer territories, they would run them, and then they would set about, once they were in full control, that's when they would set about then forcibly converting the populations underneath them. So I think that's a fundamental difference between Islam and Christianity. And I respect Islam enough to think seriously about its nature. You can moderate Islam. Islam was moderated by the Soviet Union. It was moderated by the British Raj. It was moderated by the Indonesian dictatorship. None of those are attractive examples to most Americans.
Well, you also get moderation from within, movements within Islam, which are more pacific and really less scary. Surely, in general, Sufisms, the Sufi brand of Islam, is of a very different order than raving, screaming, killing Shiites.
Yeah, I think you can certainly look at differences that were there 20, 30 years ago. I think Balkan Islam, before the collapse of Yugoslavia, was very different from the way it is in, say, Pakistan or Yemen.
Bosnia and Herzegovina, probably to this day.
No, not to this day. That's the tragedy, is that in the rubble of the civil war, the Saudis and the Iranians spent a ton of money, and you started seeing mosques being built in the Saudi
And they
Saudi
cultivated
style.
Extremity, I see, yes.
Yeah, and they radicalized the population. I was in the Central Asian stands shortly after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Had a great time with those populations who had a sort of residual Islamic nature. But not one that was not that one that dominated every aspect of life. For example, they had all these exotic local brews they liked to get high on after a certain point in the day, and you were able to get merrily drunk with these fellas in a way that you couldn't now, because again, Saudi and Iranian money went in there and radicalized those populations. In Turkmenistan, the crazy whatever he was called, Turkmenbashi, the dictator there who died a few years ago. He was a crazy guy. He renamed one of the months of the year after his mother, and he banned, I think it was ballet dancing and was it melons? No, melons he liked, but ballet dancing he thought was un-Turkmen. He had basically, he wrote his own religious book and insisted that it be taught alongside the Quran, and you had to learn his religious book in order to take the driver's test in Turkmenistan.
Mark.
And the point there is that as crazy as that guy was, he actually managed, by having a strong enough counter-pressure, he pushed back against the radicalization of Islam.
We approach the point where we're just about out of time. But to close, Mark, first I want to thank you so much for joining us on our very first podcast operation in this new format. But then, what consoling aphorism might you offer, coming really from the heart, of Mark Stein?
Well, Sid, I will start there. The words of Richard Adler and
yes.
Jerry Ross: "You gotta have heart." I was from
miles and miles and miles of heart.
Miles and miles and miles of heart from the musical Damn Yankees,
yeah.
Where the team are a bunch of losers. And the guy in one of the all-time great musical comedy cues, the manager says, "Listen, this game of baseball is only one half skill. The other half is something else. It's something bigger. You gotta have heart."
Yes.
And boom, they're into the song. And I had the great, slightly faintly surreal moment on television some years ago. I had the opportunity to sing that with Liza Minnelli and the great Broadway star Gwen Verdon and the ballerina Natalia Makarova and all kinds of strange people. But at the time after America came out, Richard Adler, the composer of that song, was celebrating a birthday. So I posted on my website this little thing of me singing "You Gotta Have Heart," and somebody said to me that a lady with a website called Pundit and Pundette said that's really what After America could have used, a CD in the back jacket flap. After you get to the air, after it's all doom, gloom, apocalyptic despair, a CD with "You Gotta Have Heart," with Mark singing "You Gotta Have Heart" right at the end of it. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. In the end, I'm an optimist, because it's not all about the numbers, whether you're talking about the debt or you're talking about the demography. Human individuals can make a difference. That's the lesson of history.
Yes, and you know,
one individual changes other people's minds, and then they change more people's minds.
Well, and
you
as
can roll this thing back
as regards where we're going and what the future will bring. Your reference to heart and how you've got to have it brings to one's thought for just a moment Blaise Pascal, who says, "Le cœur a sa raison que la raison ne connaît pas."
Yeah.
The heart has its reasons that reason itself does not comprehend. It may well be that one can remain optimistic about the human future and about the future of society, even though you can't explain why.
No, and in a way, that's absolutely right. Pascal's absolutely right, that the heart has its reasons, and we deny that. We live in a kind of hyper-rationalist age that thinks that anything and everything can be explained by appeals to reasons. But it's not. In a sense, life is a romance.
Wonderful.
And a great nation and a civilization is the romance, in the same way that it operates on a deeper transcendental level than simply talking about debt and spending and all the rest of it. And recapturing that romance is actually the game all of us who talk about these kinds of things are really in.
Well, that we must close, and I thank you most sincerely. In fact, obviously what I should say, and I say it because I deeply mean it, my heartfelt thanks to you for joining us today.
thanks to you, Milton. Congratulations on being back on the air. It's great to have you back.
Hope to see you soon.
Thanks.
Good bye, or good evening, or good morning for now.
Solo.